Bullet holes pocked the metal, and rivulets of blood had leaked from the turret's view slit. Mangrim grinned, his forehead gashed by metal splinters. "You want to get to that roof, Colonel? I can put you there."
"How?"
He held up his hands and wiggled his fingers. "I used to be a carpenter," he said. "Jesus was a carpenter. Jesus knew a lot about knives, too. That's why they crucified him. When I was a carpenter, I used to build dog houses. Only they weren't just ordinary old dog houses. Oh, no. They were castles, like the knights used to live in. See, I used to read books about castles and shit like that, 'cause I wanted those dog houses to be real special. Some of those books said interesting things."
"Like what?"
Roland asked impatiently. "Oh, like how to get to roofs." He turned his attention to Colonel Macklin. "You get me some telephone poles, barbed wire, and good sturdy lumber, and let me take a few of these wrecked cars apart. I'll put you on that roof."
"What are you planning on building?"
"Creating," Mangrim corrected. "Only it'll take me a while. I'll need help, as many men as you can spare. If I can get the right parts, I can finish it in 3 or 4 days."
"I asked you what you were planning on building."
Mangrim shrugged and dug his hands into his pockets. "Why don't we go to your trailer, and I'll draw you a picture. Might be some spies hanging around here." Macklin's gaze ran the length of the Savior's fortress. He watched the scavengers shooting some of the wounded AOE soldiers, then stripping the bodies. He almost screamed with frustration.
"It's not over," he vowed. "It's not over until I say it is."
And then he climbed down from the armored car and said to Alvin Mangrim,
"Show me what you want to build."
Chapter 74.
"Yes," Josh said. "I think we can build it back."
He felt Glory's arm clinging to him, and she leaned her head against his shoulder. He put his arm around her, and they stood together next to the burned-out ruins of the church.
"We can do it," he said. "Sure we can. I mean, it won't be tomorrow or next week, but we can do it. It probably won't look like it used to, and it might be worse than it was, but it might be better, too."
He squeezed her gently.
"Okay?"
She nodded. "Okay," she said, without looking at him, and her voice was choked with emotion. Then she lifted her tear-streaked face. Her hand came up, and her fingers slowly moved across the surface of his Job's mask. "You're a beautiful man, Josh," she said softly. "Even now. Even like this, even if it never cracked open, you'd still be the most beautiful man I've ever known."
"Oh, I'm not so hot. I never was. You should have seen me when I used to wrestle. Know what my name was? Black Frankenstein. I'd sure fit the bill now, wouldn't I?"
"No, and I don't think you ever did." Her fingers traced the hard ridges and ravines, and then she let her hand drift down again. "I love you, Josh," she said, and her voice trembled, but her copper-colored eyes were steady and true. He started to reply, but he thought of Rose and the boys. It had been so long, so long. Were they wandering somewhere, searching for food and shelter, or were they ghosts that only lived in his memories? It was torture not knowing whether they were dead or alive, and as he looked into Glory's face, he realized he would probably never know. Would it be heartless and disloyal to cut out the hope that Rose and his sons might be alive, or was it just being realistic? But he was sure of one thing. He wanted to stay in the land of the living instead of roaming the vaults of the dead. He put his arms around Glory and held her tight. He could feel the sharpness of her bones through her coat, and he longed for the day when the harvest would be gathered. He longed also to be able to see through both eyes and to be able to breathe deeply again. He hoped his Job's mask would crack soon, like Sister's had last night, but he was afraid as well. What would he look like, he wondered. What if it was the face of someone he didn't even know? But for now, he felt fine, not even a trace of fever. It was the only time in his life he'd ever wanted to be laid low. Josh saw something lying on the ground in a frozen puddle about 4 feet away. His stomach clenched, and he said quietly, "Glory, why don't you go on back home now? I'll be along in a few minutes." She pulled back, puzzled. "What is it?"
"Nothing. You just go on. I'm going to walk around for a little while and try to figure out how we can put this place back together."
"Well, I'll stay with you."
"No," he said firmly. "Go home. I want to be by myself for a while. All right?"
"All right," she agreed. She started back to the road, then turned to him again. "You don't have to say you love me," she told him. "It's okay if you don't. I just wanted you to know what I was feeling."
"I do," he said, his voice strained and tight. Glory's gaze lingered on him for a few more seconds, and then she started home. When she was gone, Josh bent down and grasped what was lying in the puddle. The ice cracked as he pulled it free. It was a piece of plaid wool, blotched with dark brown stains. Josh knew what it was from. Gene Scully's coat. He gripped the bloody cloth in his hand and straightened up, tilting his head to one side. He searched the ground around him. Another fragment of plaid cloth lay a few feet away, deeper into the alley that ran alongside the ruins. He picked that one up, too. And then he saw a third and a fourth fragment, both bloodstained, ahead of him. Little pieces of Gene Scully's coat lay scattered like plaid snow all over the ground. An animal got him, Josh thought. Whatever it was must have torn him to shreds. But he knew no animal had gotten Gene Scully. It had been a different kind of beast, maybe masquerading as a cripple in a child's red wagon, or as a black man with a silver tooth in front of his mouth. Scully had either found the man with the scarlet eye, or had been found. "Go get help," Josh told himself. "Go get Paul and Sister, and for God's sake find a rifle." But he kept following the little bits of plaid coat as his heart pumped violently and his throat went dry. There was other trash on the ground, and as Josh went deeper into the alley, a rat the size of a Persian cat waddled in front of him, gave him a beady-eyed glare, and then squeezed into a hole. Josh heard little squeakings and rustlings all around him, and he knew this part of Mary's Rest was infested with vermin. He saw frozen splatters of blood on the ground. He followed them for about 15 more feet and stopped at a circular piece of tin that lay up against the rough brick foundations of the ruined church. More frozen blood streaked the tin, and Josh could see other bits of shredded plaid around his boots. He put his foot against the piece of tin, which was about the size and shape of a manhole cover, drew a breath, and slowly let it out. Then abruptly, he shoved the tin aside and leaped back. Exposed underneath it was a hole burrowed down below the church's foundations. A cold, sour reek rose from it that made his flesh crawl. "Found you," was Josh's first thought. His second was, "Get the hell out of here. Run, you flat-footed fool." But he hesitated, staring at the hole. There was no sound from within, no movement. It's empty, Josh realized. He's gone. He took a tentative step toward the hole, then a second and a third. He stood over it, listening. Still no sound, no movement. The lair was empty. The man with the scarlet eye had gone.
After Swan had faced him down, he must have left Mary's Rest. Thank God, Josh whispered. There was a rustling behind him. Josh whirled around, his arms up to ward off a blow. A rat sat atop a cardboard box, baring its teeth. It began to squeal and chatter like an irate landlord. Josh said, "Be quiet, you little bat." Two hands, one black, one white, shot out of the hole and grasped Josh's ankles, jerking him off his feet. Josh had no time to cry out before he slammed to the ground, the air whooshing from his lungs. Dazed, he tried to scrabble free, tried to dig his fingers into the frozen earth around the hole, but the hands gripped his ankles like iron bands and began to draw him into the depths. Josh was halfway into the hole before he fully registered what had happened. He started fighting, thrashing and kicking, but the fingers only tightened. He smelled burning cloth, twisted his body, and saw blue flames dancing over the man's hands. Josh's skin was beginning to scorch, and he felt the man's hands wet and oozing like wax gloves melting. But in the next second, the flames weakened and went out. The man's hands were freezing cold again, and they yanked Josh down into darkness. The hands left his ankles. Josh kicked, felt his left boot connect. A cold, heavy form fell on him, more like a sack of ice than a body. But the knee that pressed against his throat was solid enough, trying to crush his windpipe. Blows that almost broke his bones smashed into his shoulders, chest, and ribcage. He got his hands up around a clammy throat and dug his fingers into what felt like cold putty. The thing's fists pounded his head and face, but couldn't inflict damage through the Job's mask. Josh's brain was rattled in his skull, and he was close to passing out. He knew he had two choices, fight like hell or die. He struck out with his right fist, his knuckles flattening against the angular line of a jawbone, and instantly he brought his left fist around to crash it into the man's temple. There was a grunt, more of surprise than of pain, and the weight was off Josh. He struggled to his knees, his lungs dragging in air. A freezing arm snaked around his throat from behind. Josh reached back, grabbed the fingers, and twisted them at a vicious angle. But what had been bones a second before was now like coat hanger wire. It would bend but would not break. With sheer strength, Josh lifted himself up from the floor and hurled himself backward, catching the man with the scarlet eye between himself and the church's foundation wall of rough bricks. The freezing arm slithered away, and Josh tried to scurry out of the hole. He was caught and hauled down again, and as they fought in the dark like animals, Josh saw the man's hands flicker, about to burst into flames, but they wouldn't catch, as if something had gone haywire with his ignition switch. Josh smelled an odor halfway between a struck match and a melting candle, but he kicked into the man's stomach and knocked him back. As Josh got to his feet again, a blow hammered across his shoulder, almost dislocating his arm, and flung him onto his face in the dirt. Josh twisted around to face him, his mouth bleeding and his strength running out fast. He saw the flicker of fire, and then both the man's hands grew flame again. By their blue light, he could see the man's face, a nightmare mask, and in it a gibbering, elastic mouth that spat dead flies like broken teeth. The flaming hands came toward Josh's face, and suddenly one of them sputtered and went out like a live coal doused with water. The other hand began to burn out as well, little tongues of fire rippling along the fingers. Something lay beside Josh in the dirt. He saw a bloody pile of flesh and twisted bones, and around it a number of coats, pairs of pants, sweaters, shoes, and hats. Nearby was a child's red wagon. Josh looked back at the man with the scarlet eye, who had also been Mr. Welcome. The burning hand was almost extinguished, and the man stared at the dying flame with eyes that in a human face might have been called insane.
He's not as strong as before, Josh realized, and Josh lunged for the wagon, picked it up, and smashed it into the thing's face. There was an unholy bellow. The last of the flame went out as the man staggered back. Josh saw gray light and crawled for the hole. He was about 3 feet from it when the crumpled red wagon was slammed down across the back of his head. Josh had a second to remember being thrown from a ring in Gainesville and how it felt to hit a concrete floor, and then he lay still. He awakened. How much later it was, he didn't know, to the sound of high-pitched giggling. He couldn't move, and he thought every bone in his body must have snapped. The giggling was coming from 10 or 15 feet away. It faded out, replaced by a snorting noise that became a language of some kind. German, Josh thought it might be. He made out fragments of other tongues. Chinese, French, Danish, Spanish, and more dialects that tumbled out one after the other. Then the harsh, awful voice began to speak in English with a deep southern drawl. "Always walked alone. Always walked alone. Always, always." Josh mentally explored his body, probing to find out what worked and what didn't. His right hand felt dead, maybe broken. Bands of pain throbbed at his ribs and across his shoulders, but he knew he'd been lucky. The blow he'd just survived might have crushed his skull if the Job's mask hadn't been so thick. The voice changed, skittering into a sing-song dialect Josh couldn't understand, then returned to English with a flat Midwestern accent. "The bitch. The bitch. She'll die. But not by my hand. Oh, no. Not by my hand." Josh slowly tried to turn his head. Pain shot through his spine, but his neck still worked. He gradually got his head turned toward the raving thing crouched in the dirt on the other side of the lair. The man with the scarlet eye was staring at his right hand, where weak blue flames popped along the fingers. The man's face was hung between masks. Fine blonde hair mingled with coarse black. One eye was blue and the other brown, one cheekbone sharp and the other sunken. "Not by my hand," he said. "I'll make them do it." His chin lengthened, sprouted a black stubble that turned into a red beard within seconds, and just as quickly disappeared again into the writhing matter of his face. "I'll find a way to make them do it." The man's hand trembled, began to curl into a tight fist, and the little blue flames went out. Josh gritted his teeth and started crawling for the gray light at the top of the hole, slowly and painfully, an inch at a time. He stiffened when he heard the man's voice again, singing in a whisper, "Here we go round the mulberry bush, mulberry bush, mulberry bush. Here we go round the mulberry bush, so early in the..." It trailed off into muttered gibberish. Josh pushed himself forward, closer to the hole, closer. "Run," the man with the scarlet eye said in a thin and weary voice. Josh's heart pounded because he knew the monster was speaking to him in the darkness. "Go on, run. Tell her I'll make a human hand do the work. Tell her, tell her." Josh crawled upward toward the light. "Tell her I've always walked alone." And then Josh pulled himself out of the hole, quickly drawing his legs up after him. His ribs were killing him, and he was fighting to stay conscious. But he knew he had to get away, or he was dead meat. He kept crawling as rats scurried around him. A bitter cold had leached to his bones, and he expected and dreaded the grip of the man with the scarlet eye, but it didn't come. Josh realized his life had been spared.
either because the man with the scarlet eye was weakened, or because he was worn out, or because he wanted a message sent to Swan. Tell her I'll make a human hand do the work. Josh tried to stand, but fell on his face again. It was another minute or two before he could find the strength to heave himself to his knees, and then he was finally able to stand up like a tottering, decrepit old man. He staggered along the alley to the road and started walking toward the bonfire that burned in front of Glory's shack. But before he made it, his strength gave out. He toppled like a redwood to the ground, and he did not see Robin and Mr. Pulowski running toward him. Part 13. A Five-Star General. The Wasteland. Roland's Prize. What the Junkman Saw. Friend. Swan's Decision. Robin Being Cool. Bitter Ashes. The Tide of Death and Destruction. Iron Claws. The Masters of Efficiency. Chapter 75. Roland Croninger lifted a pair of binoculars to his goggled eyes. Snow was whirling through the freezing air and had already covered most of the corpses and wrecked vehicles. Fires were burning around the mall's entrance, and he knew the Allegiance soldiers were keeping watch as well. He heard the slow rumble of thunder up in the clouds, and a spear of blue lightning streaked through the snow. He swept his gaze across the parking lot, and his binoculars revealed a frozen hand reaching from a mound of snow, a pile of bodies locked together in icy death, the gray face of a young boy staring at the dark. The Wasteland, Roland thought, yes, the Wasteland. He lowered the binoculars and leaned against the armored car that shielded him from sniper fire. The sound of hammers at work was carried past him by the wind. The Wasteland. That's what God's prayer for the final hour was about. He'd been trying to remember where he'd heard it before, only it hadn't been a prayer then, and it wasn't Sir Roland who'd heard it. It was a memory from the child Roland's mind. But it wasn't a prayer, no, not a prayer. It had been a poem. He'd awakened that morning on the bare mattress in his black trailer and thought of Miss Edna Merritt. She was one of those spinster English teachers who must have been born looking 60 years old. She taught advanced freshman English back in Flagstaff. As Roland had sat up on his mattress, he'd seen her standing beside the hand crusher, and she was holding an open copy of The New Oxford Book of English Verse. "I'm going to recite," Miss Edna Merritt announced in a voice so dry it made dust seem damp, and cutting her eyes left and right to make sure the advanced freshman English class was attentive, she'd begun to read. "Here is Belladonna, the Lady of the Rocks, the Lady of Situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel. And here is the one-eyed merchant, and this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find the hanged man. Fear death by water." And when she'd finished, she'd announced that the entire class was going to do a research paper on some facet of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, a small portion of which she had just recited. He'd made an A on the term paper, and Miss Edna Merritt had written in red on the title page, "Excellent, shows interest and intelligence." He'd thought that it showed he was a superfine bullshitter. "Bet old Miss Edna's down to the bones by now," Roland mused as he stared across the parking lot. "Bet the worms ate her from the inside out." Two possibilities intrigued him. One, that Brother Timothy was crazy and had been leading the American Allegiance to West Virginia in search of a fever dream. And two,
that there was somebody on Warwick Mountain who called himself God and spouted poetry. Maybe he had some books up there or something. But Roland recalled a puzzling thing that Brother Gary had said back in Sutton. God showed him the black box and the silver key and told him how the world will end. The black box and the silver key, Roland thought. What did that mean? He let the binoculars dangle on their strap around his neck, and he listened to the music of hammering. Then he turned around to look beyond the encampment, where Alvin Mangrim's creation was being constructed by the light of bonfires about a mile away and out of the line of sight of Allegiance sentries. The work had been going on for 3 days and 3 nights, and Colonel Macklin had supplied everything that Mangrim needed. Roland couldn't see it through the heavy snowfall, but he knew what it was. It was a damn simple thing. But he wouldn't have thought of it, and even if he had, he wouldn't have known how to put one together. He didn't like or trust Alvin Mangrim, but he had to admit that Mangrim had brains. If such a thing was good enough for a medieval army, it was certainly good enough for the Army of Excellence. Roland knew the Savior must be getting jittery by now, wondering when the next attack would come. They must be in there singing their chants good and loud by... Searing pain tore through Roland's face, and he pressed his palms against the bandages. A shuddering moan escaped his lips. He thought his head was going to explode, and then, beneath his fingers, he felt the growths under the bandages move and swell outward, like pressure seething below the crust of a volcano. Roland staggered with pain and terror as the entire left side of his face bulged outward, almost ripping the bandages loose. Frantically, he pressed his hands against his face to keep it from coming apart. He thought of the cracked fragments on the king's pillow and what had been revealed beneath, and he whimpered like a child. The pain ebbed. The movement of the bandages stopped. And then it was over, and Roland was all right. His face hadn't cracked apart. He was all right. This time the pain hadn't lasted as long as usual, either. What had happened to Colonel Macklin was a freak thing, Roland told himself. It wouldn't happen to him. He was content to wear these bandages for the rest of his life. He waited until he'd stopped shaking. It wouldn't do for anyone to see him that way. He was an officer. Then he began walking briskly across the camp toward Colonel Macklin's trailer. Macklin was seated behind his desk, going over reports from Captain Satterley about how much fuel and ammunition remained. The supplies were rapidly dwindling. "Come in," he said when Roland knocked at the door. Roland entered and Macklin said, "Close the door." Roland stood before his desk, waiting for him to look up, but dreading it too. The skeletal face, with its jutting cheekbones, exposed veins and muscles, made Macklin look like walking death. "What do you want?" Macklin asked, busy with his merciless figures. "It's almost ready," Roland said.
"The machine?"
"Yes."
"What about it?"
"We'll attack when it's finished, won't we?" The colonel put aside his pencil.
"That's right. If I can have your permission to attack, Captain."
Roland knew he was still stung from their disagreement. It was time now to mend the rift, because Roland loved the king, and also because he didn't want Alvin Mangrim to be in the king's favor and himself cast out in the cold. "I want to apologize," Roland said. "I spoke out of turn."
"We could have broken them," Macklin snapped vengefully. "One more attack was all we needed. We could have broken them right then and there."
Roland kept his eyes lowered in submission, but he knew damned well that another frontal attack would only have slaughtered more AOE soldiers.
"Yes, sir."
"If anybody else had spoken to me like that, I would have shot them down on the spot. You were wrong, Captain. Look at these goddamn figures."
He shoved the papers at Roland, and they flew from the desk.
Look how much gasoline we've got left. Look at the ammunition inventory. You want to see how much food we have? We're sitting here starving, and we could have had the allegiance of supply 3 days ago if we attacked then.
He slammed his black-gloved hand down on the desk, and the oil lantern jumped.
And it's your fault, Captain, not mine. I wanted to attack. I have faith in the Army of Excellence. Go on. Get out.
Roland didn't move.
I gave you an order, Captain.
I have a request to make, Roland said quietly.
You're in no position to make requests.
I'd like to request, Roland continued doggedly, that I lead the first assault wave when we break through.
Captain Carr's leading it.
I know you gave him permission, but I'd like to ask you to change your mind. I want to lead the first wave.
It's an honor to lead an assault wave. I don't think you're deserving of an honor, do you?
He paused and then leaned back in his chair.
You've never asked to lead an assault wave before. Why now?
Because I want to find someone, and I want to capture him alive.
And who might that be?
The man who calls himself Brother Timothy, Roland replied. I want him alive.
We're not taking prisoners. They're all going to die. Every one.
The black box and the silver key, Roland said.
What?
God showed Brother Timothy the black box and the silver key and told him how the world will end. I'd like to know more about what Brother Timothy says he saw on that mountaintop.
Have you lost your mind? Or did they brainwash you when you went in there?
I agree that Brother Timothy is probably insane, Roland said, keeping his composure. But if he's not, then who's calling himself God? And what's the black box and the silver key?
They don't exist.
Probably not. There might not even be a Warwick Mountain, but if there is, Brother Timothy could be the only one who knows how to find it. I think capturing him alive might be worth the effort.
Why? You want the Army of Excellence to go looking for God, too?
No. But I want to lead the first assault wave, and I want Brother Timothy taken alive. Roland knew it sounded like an order, but he didn't care. He stared fixedly at the king. There was silence. Macklin's left hand squeezed into a fist, then slowly unclenched.
I'll think about it.
I'd like to know right now. Macklin leaned forward. His mouth curved into a thin and terrible smile.
Don't push me, Roland. I won't stand to be pushed, not even by you.
Brother Timothy, Roland said, is to be taken alive. We can kill everyone else, but not him. I want him able to answer questions, and I want to know about the black box and the silver key. Macklin rose like a dark cyclone slowly unfurling. But before he could answer, there was another knock at the trailer's door.
What is it?
Macklin shouted. The door opened and Sergeant Benning came in. He immediately felt the tension.
I've brought a message from Corporal Mangrum, sir.
I'm listening.
He says it's ready. He wants you to come see it.
Tell him I'll be there in 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Benning started to turn away.
Sergeant, Roland said.
Tell him we'll be there in 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Benning glanced quickly at the colonel and then got out as fast as he could. Macklin was filled with cold rage.
You're walking close to the edge, Roland. Very close.
Yes, I am. But you won't do anything. You can't. I helped you build all this. I helped you put it together.
If I hadn't amputated your hand in Earth House, you'd be dust by now. If I hadn't told you to use the drugs to trade with, we'd still be dirt warts. And if I hadn't executed Freddy Kempka for you, there'd be no army of excellence. You ask my advice, and you do what I say. That's how it's always been. The soldiers bow to you, but you bow to me. The bandages tightened as Roland smiled. He'd seen the flicker of uncertainty, no, of weakness in the king's eyes, and he realized the truth. I've always kept the brigades operating for you, and I've even found the settlements for us to attack. You can't even allocate the supplies without going to pieces.
You little bastard,
Macklin managed to say.
I should have you shot.
You won't. You used to say I was your right hand, and I believed it. But that was never true, was it? You're my right hand. I'm the real king, and I've just let you wear the crown.
Get out. Get out. Get out.
Macklin felt dizzy, and he grabbed the edge of the desk to steady himself.
I don't need you. I never did.
You always did. You do now.
No. No, I don't. I don't.
He shook his head and looked away from Roland, but he could still feel Roland's eyes on him, probing to his soul with surgical precision. He remembered the eyes of the skinny kid who had been sitting in Earthhouse's town hall during the newcomer's orientation, and he remembered seeing something of himself in them, determined, willful, and, above all, cunning. I'll still be the king's knight, Roland said. I like the game. But from now on, we won't pretend it's you who makes the rules. Macklin suddenly lifted his right arm and started to swipe the nail-studded palm across Roland's face, but Roland didn't move, didn't flinch. Macklin's skeletal face was twisted with rage, and he trembled, but didn't deliver the blow. He made a gasping sound like a punctured balloon, and the room seemed to spin crazily around him. In his mind, he heard the hollow, knowing laughter of the Shadow Soldier. The laughter went on for a long time, and when it was over, Macklin's arm dropped to his side. He stood staring at the floor, his mind on a filthy pit where only the strong survived. We should go see Mangrum's machine now, Roland suggested. And this time his voice was softer, almost gentle, the voice of a boy again. I'll give you a ride in my jeep. All right? Macklin didn't answer. But when Roland turned and walked to the door, Macklin followed like a dog humbled by a new master. Chapter 76. Headlights darkened. Three rows of Army of Excellence vehicles moved slowly across the parking lot as howling winds blew snow in blinding cross currents. Visibility was cut to 9 or 10 feet in all directions, but the blizzard had given the AOE a chance to clear some of the debris off the parking lot with two of its three bulldozers. They'd shoved the frozen corpses and twisted metal into huge heaps on either side of what the AOE infantrymen now called Death Valley. Roland rode in his jeep at the center of the first row, with Sergeant McGowan behind the wheel. Under his coat, he wore a shoulder holster with a .38 in it, and at his side was an M16. On the floorboard, behind his right boot, were a flare gun and two red flares. He knew it was going to be a very good day. Soldiers rode on the hoods, trunks, and fenders of the vehicles, adding weight to help traction. Behind the advancing waves followed 1,200 more AOE soldiers. Captain Carr controlled the left flank, and on the far side of Roland's jeep, Captain Wilson was in command of the right. Both of them, along with the other officers involved in Operation Crucify, had gone over the plans with Roland several times, and Roland had told them exactly what he expected. There was to be no hesitation when the signals were given, and the maneuvers had to be done precisely as Roland had outlined. There was to be no retreat, Roland had told them. The first man who shouted a retreat was to be shot on the field. And as the orders were given and the plan gone over again and again, Colonel Macklin had sat silent behind his desk. Oh, yes, Roland thought, delirious with a keen mingling of excitement and fear. It's going to be a good day. The vehicles continued to advance, foot by foot, the noise of their engines covered by the shriek of the wind. Roland wiped snow from his goggles. Down the first line of trucks and cars, soldiers began to slide off the hoods and fenders and scrabble forward on their hands and knees across the snow. They were members of the recon brigade that Roland had organized, small, fast men who could get up close to the Allegiance defense line without being seen. Roland strained forward in his seat, watching for the Allegiance's bonfires. Even now, he knew the recon brigade soldiers were taking up positions on the far left and right flanks, and they would be the first to open fire when the signals were given. If the recon brigade successfully drew enemy attention to the far left and far right of the defensive line, there might be a hole of confusion right in the center, and it was there that Roland planned to pierce. Orange light flickered ahead, firelight, glowing from one of the bonfires on the defensive line. Roland cleared his goggles again, saw the glint of another bonfire to the left and maybe 30 yards away. He picked up the flare gun and loaded one flare into the breech. Then, with the second flare in his gloved left hand, he stood up in the jeep and waited for the assault wave to close another 5 yards. Now, Roland decided, and he aimed the flare gun just over the windshields of the vehicles on the left flank. He squeezed the trigger, and the gun coughed. The brilliant crimson flare streaked away, and the first signal had been delivered. The vehicles on the left side began to pivot, the entire line veering further left. Roland quickly reloaded and delivered the second signal on the right flank. The vehicles on that side slowed and began to veer to the right. Sergeant McGowan, too, cut the wheel to the right side. The tires skidded over the snow for a few seconds before they responded. Roland was counting the time down. 8, 7, 6. He saw white flashes of gunfire from the far left flank, right up on the Allegiance's defensive line, and he knew the recon brigade on that side had gone to work. 5, 4. Gunfire erupted on the far right flank. Roland saw sparks fly as bullets ricocheted off metal. 3, 2. On the left side, the AOE vehicles suddenly turned on their headlights, the blinding shafts of light spearing through the snow and into the eyes of the Allegiance sentries, not more than 10 yards away. A fraction of a second later, the headlights on the right side came on. Machine gun bullets fired in blind panic by a sentry threw up plumes of snow 6 feet in front of Roland's jeep. 1, Roland counted. And the massive thing, half machine and half a construction from a medieval nightmare that had been following 30 feet behind the command jeep, suddenly roared forward. Its treads flattening corpses and debris, its steel scoop raised to shield against gunfire. Roland watched the huge war machine as it swept past, gaining speed, heading for the center of the enemy's defenses. "Go!" Roland shouted. "Go! Go!" Mangrum's brainchild was powered by the third bulldozer, its driver inside an armor-plated cab. But towed by steel cables behind the bulldozer was a wide wooden platform with truck axles and wheels attached. Rising from the platform was an intricate wooden framework made from sturdy telephone poles bolted and lashed together to support a central staircase that ascended more than 70 feet into the air. The stairs had been taken from houses in the dead residential district around the shopping center. The long staircase curved slightly forward at the pinnacle and ended in a ramp that could be unhinged and dropped outward like the drawbridge of a castle. Barbed wire and scavenged pieces of metal from wrecked cars covered the outside surfaces, with gun ports cut here and there on several of the staircase landings. To help support the weight, some of the telephone poles had been driven onto iron spikes bolted to the bulldozer, and they thrust upward to hold the war machine steady. Roland knew what it was. He'd seen pictures of them in books. Alvin Mangrum had built a siege tower like medieval armies had used to storm fortified castles. And then the bulldozer's upraised scoop crashed into a mailman's armored truck that was covered with graffiti like "Love the Savior" and "Kill in the Name of Love," and began to shove it backward out of the defensive line. The mailman's truck slammed into a car, and the car was crushed between it and an armored Toyota van as the bulldozer pressed forward, its engine screaming and the treads throwing back wakes of snow. The siege tower shivered and creaked like arthritic bones, but it was built strong, and it held. Gunfire flared from the left and right flanks of the Allegiance's defenses, but the soldiers who manned the center were forced back in confusion, some of them being crushed to death at once as the bulldozer came powering through. Through the hole the bulldozer had opened rushed a swarm of shouting AOE infantrymen, dealing out more death from their guns. Bullets whined and sparked off metal, and further down the line, a gas tank was hit and exploded, lighting up the battleground with a hellish glare. The bulldozer pushed the wreckage aside and kept going. When its steel shovel slammed against the fortress's wall, the driver cut his engine and locked the brakes. A truck loaded with soldiers and 10 drums of gasoline roared through the hole the bulldozer and siege tower had broken open and skidded to a stop alongside. As other infantrymen supplied a covering fire, some of the soldiers began to unload the gasoline drums, while the rest, who carried coils of rope, ran to the siege tower and started up the steps. At the top, they unlocked the ramp and shoved it forward. On the underside of the ramp were hundreds of long nails which dug into the snow on the mall's roof as the ramp fell into place. Now, there was a 7-foot-long wooden bridge connecting the tower and the roof. One by one, the soldiers ran across it, and once on the roof, they began to drop the ends of their ropes to the men who were rolling the gasoline drums against the wall. The ropes were already looped and knotted, and as one was slipped around the end of a drum, another was tied to the other end. The drums of gasoline were hauled up to the roof, one after the other, in quick succession. More soldiers streamed up the siege tower, took their places at the gun ports, and fired down at the mass of Allegiance infantry who were retreating toward the mall's entrance. And then the soldiers on the rooftop began to roll the gasoline drums through the central skylight and down into the densely packed midst of the American Allegiance, many of whom had been sleeping and still didn't know what was going on. As the drums hit bottom, the soldiers took aim and fired with their rifles, puncturing the drums and spewing gasoline into the air. The bullets threw sparks, and with a tremendous whoomp, the gasoline ignited. Standing up in his Jeep, Roland saw flame leap into the night through the shattered skylight. "We've got them!" he shouted. "Now we've got them!" Beneath the skylight in the shopping mall's crowded atrium, men, women, and children were dancing to Roland Croninger's tune. More gasoline drums plummeted through the skylight, exploding like napalm bombs in the conflagration. Within 2 minutes, the entire floor of the atrium was awash with blazing gasoline. Hundreds of bodies were charring as hundreds more tried to fight free, trampling their brothers and sisters, clawing for a breath of air in the firestorm. Now the rest of the Army of Excellence vehicles were crashing into the Allegiance's defensive line, and the air burned with bullets. A flaming figure ran past Roland's Jeep and was broken like a straw doll beneath the wheels of an oncoming truck. The Allegiance soldiers were panicking, not knowing which way to run, and the ones who tried to fight were slaughtered.
Smoke was streaming from the mall's entrance, and still the men on the rooftop continued to drop the gasoline drums. Roland heard the explosions even over the screams and gunfire. Army of Excellence soldiers were breaking into the mall. Roland picked up his M16 and jumped from the jeep, running through the confusion of bodies toward the entrance. A tracer bullet streaked past his face, and he tripped and fell over mangled bodies, but he got up again and kept going. His gloves had turned crimson, and somebody's blood covered the front of his coat. He liked the color. It was the color of a soldier. Inside the mall, he was surrounded by dozens of AOE infantry who were shooting at enemy soldiers in the stores. Gray smoke churned through the air, and people on fire came running down the corridor, but most of them crumpled before they got very far. The floor shook with the blasts as the final gasoline drum blew, and Roland felt a sickening wave of heat from the atrium ahead. He smelled the intoxicating reek of burning flesh, hair, and clothes. More explosions jarred the floor, and Roland thought, it must be the Allegiance's ammunition going off. Allegiance soldiers started throwing aside their guns and coming out of the stores begging for mercy. They received none. "You, you, and you," Roland shouted, pointing out three soldiers. "Follow me." He raced in the direction of the bookstore. The atrium was a solid mass of flame. The heat was so terrible that the hundreds of corpses were beginning to liquefy, oozing and melting together. Searing winds screamed around the walls. Roland's coat was smoking as he ran past the atrium into the corridor that led to the bookstore. The three soldiers followed right behind. But Roland suddenly stopped, his eyes widening with terror. One of the Allegiance's tanks, the Love Bug, was parked in front of the B. Dalton store. The soldier behind him said, "Oh, gee." The tank's main cannon fired. There was an ear-cracking boom that blew the rest of the glass from the store's windows. But the cannon's elevation was too high, and the shell's hot wake threw Roland and the other men to the ground as it passed 4 feet overhead. It pierced the roof at the end of the corridor without exploding and blasted like a thunderclap about 50 feet in the air, killing most of the soldiers who had dropped the gasoline drums. Roland and the soldiers opened fire, but their bullets pinged harmlessly off armor. The tank jerked forward, began to grind toward them, and then stopped, backed up, and started turning to the right. Its turret began to rotate, and then the cannon went off again, this time knocking a truck-sized hole through the brick wall. There was a noise of gears grinding and stripping, and with a backfire that gouted gray smoke, the multi-million-dollar machine shuddered and stopped. Either the driver doesn't know what he's doing, Roland thought, or the tank's a lemon. The hatch opened. A man popped up with his arms raised. "Don't shoot!" he shouted. "Please don't!" He was interrupted by the force of bullets passing through his face and neck, and he slithered back into the tank. Two Allegiance soldiers with rifles appeared at the B. Dalton entrance and started shooting. The AOE infantryman to Roland's right was killed, but in another few seconds, the firefight was over, and the two Allegiance men lay riddled. The way into the bookstore was clear. Roland dove to the floor as a shot rang out, closely followed by a second. The other two men fired repeatedly into the gloom at the back of the store, but there was no more enemy resistance. Roland kicked the storeroom door open and leapt to one side, ready to fill the room with bullets if any more soldiers were in there guarding the Savior. But there was no movement, no sound. A single oil lantern glowed within the storeroom. His rifle ready, Roland darted in and crouched on the floor. The Savior, wearing a lime-green coat and beige slacks with patched knees, was sitting in his chair. His hands gripped the armrests. His head was tilted back, and Roland could see the fillings in his molars. Blood was trickling from a bullet hole between his eyes.
A second bullet hole was black and scorched against the lime-green coat over his heart. As Roland watched, the Savior's hands suddenly opened and closed in a convulsion. But he was dead. Roland knew very well what a dead man looked like. Something moved just beyond the light. Roland aimed his rifle.
"Come out, now. Your hands above your head."
There was a long pause, and Roland almost squeezed off a few rounds. But then the figure stepped into the light, hands upraised. In one hand was a .45 automatic. It was Brother Timothy, his face ashen, and Roland knew he'd been right. He was sure the Savior wouldn't let Brother Timothy very far from his side.
"Drop the gun," Roland ordered.
Brother Timothy smiled faintly. He brought his hands down, turned the .45's barrel toward his own temple, and squeezed the trigger.
"No!"
Roland shouted, already moving forward to stop him, but the .45 clicked and clicked and clicked.
"I was supposed to kill him," Brother Timothy said as the .45 continued clicking on an empty clip. "He told me to. He said the heathen had won, and that my last act was to deliver him from the hands of the heathen, and then to deliver myself. That's what he told me. He showed me where to shoot him in two places."
"Put it down," Roland said. Brother Timothy grinned, and a tear streaked from each eye.
"But there were only two bullets in the gun. How was I supposed to deliver myself if there were only two bullets in the gun?"
He continued clicking the trigger until Roland took the gun, and then he sobbed and crumpled to his knees. The floor shook as the atrium's roof, weakened by the flames, 7 years of neglect, and the tons of water from melted snow, collapsed onto the burning corpses. Most of the gunfire had stopped. The battle was almost over, and Roland had won his prize. Chapter 77. One afternoon, as new snow drifted across Mary's Rest, a panel truck with a sagging suspension entered town from the north. Its backfiring engine immediately made it the center of attention. But new people were coming in almost every day now, some in beat-up old cars and trucks, some in horse-drawn wagons, and most on foot with their belongings in cardboard boxes or suitcases. So newcomers didn't draw the curiosity they once had. Painted in big red letters on both sides of the truck was "The Junk Man." The driver's name was Vulcevic, and he and his wife, two sons and daughter, had been following the pattern of a new society of wanderers, staying in a settlement long enough to find food and water and rest, and then realizing there must be a better place somewhere else. Vulcevic was a former bus driver from Milwaukee who'd been laid low with a flu bug the day his city was destroyed, and whether that was good fortune or bad, he still hadn't decided. For the past 2 weeks, he'd been hearing rumors from people they'd met on the road. Ahead was a town called Mary's Rest, and in that town there's a spring with water as sweet as the Fountain of Youths. "They've got a cornfield there, and apples fall from the sky, and they've got a newspaper, and they're building a church. And in that town," so the rumors had gone, "there's a girl named Swan who has the power of life." Vulcevic and his family had the dark hair, eyes, and olive complexions of generations of gypsy blood. His wife was particularly attractive, with a sharply chiseled, proud face, long black hair streaked with gray, and dark brown eyes that seemed to sparkle with light. Less than a week before, the helmet of growths that had covered her face and head had cracked open, and Vulcevic had left a lantern burning for the Virgin Mary in the midst of a snow-shrouded forest. As Vulcevic drove deeper into town, he did indeed see a water hole, right out in the middle of the road. A bonfire burned just past it, and further along the road, people were reconstructing a clapboard building that might have been a church. Volsevic knew this was the place, and he did what he and his family had done in every settlement they'd come across. He stopped the truck in the road, and then his two boys opened the truck's sliding rear panel and started hauling out the boxes full of items for sale or trade, among which were many of their father's own inventions. Volsevic's wife and daughter set up tables to display the goods on, and by that time Volsevic had an old megaphone to his lips, and it started his salesman spiel. "Come on, folks!